This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Staying home for weeks on end has brought many people a unique opportunity for introspection. If we can quiet the noise in our household for long enough, there's plenty of time to think about all the ways that we can change and grow now and in the future. Omid Safi is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University, and he's developed an online course to help guide students in that mission. And he's turning to a familiar source for inspiration, the 13th century mystic poet Rumi. In a series of new online lectures called Illuminated Courses, Omid explores what the poet has to teach us about radical love and embracing times of suffering. Omid Safi is with me now. Welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
And how are you doing and your family?
Well, I think as Rumi and these sages would tell us, how is your heart, my friend? That's a great question for us to be asking each other, especially in these times.
Well, I want to talk about Rumi and the course because, you know, you mentioned that and you start out by saying, well, you know, what would Rumi say? I think a lot of people had come to Rumi possibly because he represented the anti-authoritarian form of spirituality. They liked him because he didn't represent the angry God. And so here was this ecstatic lover. And a mysticism we can get into. But he really does, and particularly in the work that you illuminate, talk about the root of suffering, how to find it, and how getting to that root, going to the root of suffering, is the thing that'll bring us the most happiness.
Isn't it that amazing? You know, there's so many teachings that talk about follow this path and you will be enlightened, and follow this path and you will be saved, and you will be blessed. But Rumi doesn't do that. He actually starts with us where we are and says, you know, my friend, I care about you and you've got to deal with your own suffering. What is causing you pain? And in his language, you've got to go into the root of the root of your soul. You've got to have the courage to look deep within your heart and the heart of your heart. And so many of us are hesitant to do that because we can't even confront the suffering in our own selves, much less the suffering around us and in somebody else. So he starts with us where we are and then takes us on this journey of love where we come to connect our own being with the being of other people. It's an extraordinary teaching.
Well, it is, and a difficult one. And I think, for those who thought that Rumi was just about, you know, ecstasy and love, and thank goodness we don't have to think about the bad things anymore, they could be disappointed because either you have this transactional God who says, you know, you say, look, I can't handle this anymore. My life is miserable. How about if I do these 9 things for you, God, would you fix it for me and buy me a car? There's that God.
It's a drive-through God.
The drive-through God, the transactional. Yeah. I'll give you 9 Hail Marys and you give me a dollar. But then there's this idea that, oh, you don't have to do any of that. Just you know, be blissful. And no, Rumi's not saying that either. And I think that's a sort of a powerful teaching. Why did you decide to take on this? Talk about the particular work that you decided to look into and give us this view of Rumi. Why this? Why now?
You know, I was looking around at the start of the quarantine. I'm blessed enough to be married to somebody who is a lot smarter than I am. And I think like a lot of other people, I was so focused on everything that we were told we are not allowed to do. You know, we shouldn't do this and we shouldn't do that. And my wife is a gardener, and very wisely she said, you know, things come in seasons. And there's a time that the life of the plants goes down to the roots, and they're not actually dead at that time. The life is retreating to the root, and it's going to be rejuvenated, and it's going to come back out. So she said, you know, you're always teaching about this stuff. How about if we practice it and say, what would it be like for us to use this time of social distancing as a chance to go deep within yourself and offer something to people? And I'd always had a good excuse. I was like, well, you know, I'm too busy. I've got to do this and I got to do that. And I was like, nope, actually, I'm stuck at home. I'm not going anywhere. And I was looking around and I was noticing that a lot of my friends, a lot of my students were hurting because they were cut off from their sources of support. You know, for example, for a lot of my Christian friends, the Good Friday and Easter season was coming up and they weren't going to be able to go to church. And I thought, what if we take these teachings and we put it online so that people can access it from wherever they are? And that's how we ended up with these illuminated courses.
Well, and Ramadan began last week. So what's it been like for you to enter this season and this year under such different circumstances?
You know, Ramadan is a time where you're supposed to connect together the purification of your own heart to the suffering of other people. You don't just fast from food and drink. You're also supposed to fast from negative thoughts and from anger and hatred and all of that. And then you're supposed to take the meals that you're not eating and share it with people who are hungry. So it is, in some ways, both a time of inner inspection and a time of social service. And then now that in some ways we are not able to go into our mosques, go into our Islamic centers, go and have these larger family gatherings, I thought, again, let me try to find a way of taking the jewels and the gems of this tradition and put it online. And it's been so rewarding to see people, I think it's 15 different countries now, who are coming on to these illuminated courses. And some of them are sitting down every night and watching one of these lessons with their families. And it warms my heart to know that just because we're physically distant, it doesn't mean that we have to be socially and spiritually distant from one another.
And to give us a sense of what these teachings are and the way that you're sort of going through this, because you take us really through, you talk about the book itself, its meaning, the way in which it's, in fact, in some ways interprets the Quran, but also there are stories that illuminate various aspects of this, of these teachings. And maybe I could get you to talk about the story of the king, the maiden, the healer, and the smith as a good example of an upending story, one that really is kind of painful. It's a little difficult. It goes along just fine until.
Well, you know, it's a little bit like when you start to read the Quran or you start to read the Bible, and then some of the characters in the book start to act in these very unholy ways. And you're like, wait, you're not supposed to do that. And to kind of give it away, in this story, there's a king who falls in love with a maiden, and the maiden is in love with somebody else. So the king does, as a lot of biblical kings do, he has the rival offed. He has them killed. And you're reading this, and you're like, dude, bro, like, you're not supposed to do that. Like, what part of thou shalt not kill did you miss?
Right.
And then Rumi steps into the narrative, and he's like, you think he's doing something wrong, don't you? And you're like, wait, who are you talking to? And Rumi goes, I'm talking to you, the reader. And you're like, you're like stopping the storytelling? He's like, yep. What did you think of what he just did? And you're like, oh, I thought he did something terrible. And then Rumi goes, well, guess what? You are the king. You are the maiden. And you are the rival. None of these characters are outside of you. They all correspond to a tendency within you. And so he constantly is getting you to see that the characters in his novel, in his poetry book, are not taking place in some external plane. That these are all tendencies that we have. And then you come to see that the king and the maiden is really about the marriage of the heart and the soul. And in order for the heart and soul to be together, you got to deal with the crud of your ego.
Well, what's even,
like, wow, I've never gotten that.
The crud of your ego. And what's even more subversive about the story is the first thing the king does when he finds out that the maiden is in love with somebody else, he said, well, you know what? Let's bring them together. I'm the king.
Let's bring them together.
And let's let them, you know, bring this thing to fruition, because I'm a king. I'm a magnanimous guy. And you think, well, that's a nice thing for him to do. He was in love with her, but he rewards her with her heart's delight. And then after a year or so, does him in and brings the maiden to a deeper understanding. And boy, I mean, if you ever wanted to take a lesson in consciousness building and consciousness development and how what we thought was bringing us happiness is not the final destination, that's fantastic.
Exactly.
But it's upending. I mean, it's not what you expect.
It does. And I think one of the biggest lessons that Rumi has to offer us in this age, and this is one of the things that I constantly am trying to emphasize, is so many of us are always talking about love. And everybody talks about looking for love and searching for love. And the problem that we have is that we have so narrowly defined love as a kind of physical and romantic, even sexual kind of love. And we may or may not have that in our own life. And so we feel like we're just dying of thirst, as Rumi would say, when we're standing knee deep in this ocean of love. So he, in a way, he's offering us this very expansive sense of love, where it is about the love of a neighbor, of a friend, of a teacher, of a parent, of a stranger. And to get you to connect your love for yourself, and you've got to learn to love yourself fully, to the love of other people. And that's where service comes in. That's where tenderness comes in. So I find that actually this very, as you say, subversive move by taking what we thought was the only way in which we were supposed to look for love and expand it to encompass the whole of humanity.
That, how do you think that lesson plays now? Because if I'm right, and you can disabuse me of this, but my sense was that there was a kind of a way in which Rumi was accepted and broadly popular because people loved the sort of the joy and the effusive ecstasy in it. This is a different message, and I wonder how this is being received, or if you think this is now the time to expose this Rumi.
I think every age is the age for Rumi. I think because every age is the age for love and every age is the age for justice. I mean, we know this from the prophetic dimension of every religious tradition. When love comes into public, we call it justice. When that same love moves inward, we call it tenderness. So, I mean, look at where we are right now in this age of COVID-19. Who are we clapping for? We're clapping for the essential workers, the healthcare providers, the grocery store workers who are putting their life at risk by extending themselves in service towards others, right? These are the people that we are cherishing because for once we get it that we're in this together, that our well-being and our well-doing is intertwined because our existence is deeply intertwined. I hope that when this is over, that we don't just go back to quote-unquote normal, whatever that was, but this new awareness of our intertwined reality based on a life of love and justice and tenderness is something that we carry with us. And hopefully these teachings of Rumi and, you know, these illuminated courses can be a small part of that.
Do you think, I mean, I'm gonna hold you now to account for that. You hope that we'll come out. What do you think is going to happen?
I think the best answer I can give you is I think this is an apocalypse. But I say that mischievously as a religion professor. Apocalypse not as the end of the world, though it may feel like it, but apocalypse in the literal sense, which is unveiling. I think what this crisis, like every crisis, is doing is that it's pulling the veils off of our eyes and it's letting us see that the society that we were living in wasn't actually working for so many people and it wasn't serving the whole of what makes us human. So that's what I think the future has to look like. If we have enough money for the most vast kind of economy and the richest nation in the history of the planet, but we don't have enough to actually take care of the health of all of us, then I don't know that we've built a loving society. So my hope is that what's in the future will be a reprioritization of our values. As Dr. King would have said, we need a radical revolution of values in our society. That's what I hope is in our future.
Has this pandemic changed the way you understand your religion?
It has. It has. I used to say that it is stripped it down to the core and be much more focused on family, on my loved ones, on my neighbors, on simple home-cooked meals. Again, my wife has given me a better language for it. It's not so much that it's stripped down. I feel like it's distilled It is taking it to the core, it's taking it to the heart. And I realized that something as simple as waking up with life is actually a gift to be grateful for, that having my children around the table and being able to cook a meal for them is an extraordinary blessing. And knowing that my elderly parents are still with us and still gracing my life and this earth with their being, that that's something to be observed in gratitude.
Omid Safi, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, my friend.
Omid Safi, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University and the creator of Illuminated Courses. You can find out more about the show and about the classes at our website, stateofthings.org. And we're going to bring back our Movies on the Radio segment next week. And we want to hear from you about movies that give you a strong sense of place, maybe a place that's not your living room. What films have transported you? Which movies have captured the character of a location? Tell us your pick by sending us an email at sot@wunc.org or tweet at us at #SOTMovie. That's our program for today. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Budarsky helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.